Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Ariana Betti, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Amsterdam. Her new book, Against Facts, is just out from the MIT Press. The British philosopher and logician Bertrand Russell once said that it is a truism that there are facts. For example, the planets revolve around the sun, 2 plus 2 equals 4, elephants are bigger than mice, and so on. In Against Facts, Betti argues that not only is it not a truism that there are facts, but that on either of the basic views of what facts are, there aren't any. Betti argues that we don't need to posit facts either as truth makers or as the reference of that clauses. We can express truths about the world and provide an adequate semantics without needing recourse to entities called facts. Her finely articulated discussion of facts and her rebuttal of such defenders of facts as Russell, David Armstrong, Kit Fine, and other philosophers will be a primary source of discussions about facts and related notions of propositions and states of affairs for years to come. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Ariana Betti, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm here. Delighted to be here.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you.
I'm very pleased to be talking about your new book, Against Facts. It should be a very, very interesting conversation about, you know, contemporary metaphysics and discussion about facts and propositions and states of affairs and all sorts of related cognate notions that have to do with, you know, establishing and speaking truths. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the book itself, maybe you can say a word about your background as a philosopher, how you came to philosophy and how you came to write this particular book.
So my interest in philosophy started, I would say, especially in high school. So in high school, I was one of those fortunate people who could study philosophy. And what fascinated me about it was that simply the level of abstractness. So I just wanted to go to the most abstract way to looking at things. So I took philosophy. I took up philosophy in a university, and I was immediately fascinated by logic. I did not become a logician, or at least not one of those technical logicians that prove theorems, but my attention was caught by history of logic. So, in fact, I become a historian of logic, and what fascinates me the most is, in fact, tracing concepts through time, and that's what I do, in fact, right now. And I happened to stumble on the concept of facts at a certain point while writing my dissertation. My PhD dissertation was on time, truth, and logic from Bolzano, so an Austrian philosopher, to the Lwów Warsaw School, so the Polish School of Logic. And in that that period that I was studying, it emerges a connection between truth in language and what is called the ontology of truth. So whatever in reality that corresponds to a truth or a truth statement. And what I saw, what I experienced is that in my dissertation, this particular point of exactly what in time or in this stretch of time in this period, in this tradition, corresponded exactly to truths was not completely satisfactory. And I was left, after having finished my dissertation, with the question, but what does exactly correspond to a truth in, say, 19th century conceptualizations on truth and ontology of truth? And then I discovered that I didn't know that much, and I was left a bit, understudied in my work back then, and I took up the research. I followed up with studies that were more systematic, say. I stumbled upon the notion, and by in wanting to clarify it, I discovered that I was not convinced that facts exist. So I encountered, of course, contemporary writings on facts, on propositions, on states of affairs, and I started simply taking up issues with them.
Okay, good. So, I mean, one of the, you start and end, you sort of bookend the book itself, you know, quoting Bertrand Russell, right, famously, mm-hmm. you know, saying that, you know, it's a truism. Of course there are facts, and then we can just go on from there, right? I mean, we're just going to take that as a kind of a Morian fact, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you kind of, you know, very slowly, you know, methodically kind of demolish that view, you know, over two parts, you know, and, you know, each part of the book is devoted to a different kind of basic notion of facts, of which there are various iterations. You know, one of those is what you call the compositional facts that are sort of, you know, the states of affairs type. And then the others are the propositional facts, which are the sort of reference of that clause's type.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about each of those types and why neither of them, you know, why we don't have to posit either of those types. Mm-hmm. But you, in the first chapter, you begin by establishing certain ground rules about, you know, how do we make this decision about whether there is something or not, you know, whether it's facts or anything else, right? You know, other than, say, maybe what's right in front of our eyes perceptually. But as far as more theoretical or abstract entities goes, you know, things get a little bit more dicey. So can you say something about what your basic methodological, you know, sort of the background of how your discussion will proceed?
Yes, sure. So one, I felt that what was needed, and it's something that I'm convinced is more often needed than it seems. So I felt it was needed that I started out by saying how I go about the question, how do we decide about what exists? So that was quite important because the book can be read in two ways. One is in this way, so that the book says that facts don't exist, simply. And the other way to read the book is to say, well, the book says that there are no good arguments mm-hmm. for facts or to accept facts. To me, these two questions are actually two sides of the same coin. And the reason is that, so I wanted to be very explicit on that, and the reason is that I think that the way we can decide about what exists is only on the basis of a certain kind of arguments. And these arguments are arguments to the best explanation. So that's basically the difference between what exists and what we are justified in assuming that exists, given arguments to the best explanation. To me, there is no difference between them. So that's something that you might or might not accept while reading this book. If you accept the way I go about arguments in favor of the existence of certain entities, then you would simply agree that there are no facts. Instead, if you don't agree and say, look, whatever you can say, however you can argue in favor or against certain entities, you know, in fact, you do not accomplish this in the book. The only thing you show is that we have no good reasons mm-hmm. to accept facts.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's the very general approach to the book. And then, of course, these assume certain very specific a specific shape as regards facts, for instance, because then the next step would be, okay, once that you arrive to defining what an argument for the best explanation would be in the case of facts, then there is a connection I make between best explanation and, in fact, the roles that entities can play mm-hmm. in an explanation. So the next question is, okay, so what does it mean for an argument for facts or for an entity to follow or to be justified from an argument or by an argument to the best explanation. And then I say is that it is that there is a reason to accept that a certain entity plays a certain role, so that you have to accept an entity as such in a certain role to be essentially played by it.
Okay.
Is this clear?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You get into the whole idea of, you know, Quinean ontological commitment later. So, but let me just, you know, just to kind of locate the discussion, mm-hmm. you know, from the basic, I mean, you know, you're saying there aren't any facts, or we have no good reasons to posit facts, or we have certain roles and there's no reason to think that there are these entities, you know, called facts that are essentially that are central for filling those roles.
Yeah.
I mean, those are all kind of different ways of saying the same thing. But, you know, at the same time, just as a, you know, maybe a very flat footed way to think about it, you're not denying that, you know, that there are facts in the sense that, you know, the Earth revolves around the sun and, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 and so forth. It's a much more technical.
Yeah,
but how is? Can you say something about how this technical debate, you know, sort of is derived from or comes out of the ordinary way we talk about, you know, facts all the time? I mean,
yeah,
you know, there's a fact that we are engaged in an interview right now or a conversation, right? I mean, I would talk that way, right?
Yes.
So can you just sort of connect our ordinary kind of idea? Well, you know, of course there are facts. I mean, newspapers are full of facts, and you know, the reporters try to get just the facts. You know?
Yes, there are, of course, also expressions such as in different languages there are exceptions. Expressions that I use in such a way that the fact seems to be simply an accomplished feat, or something that in your examples is very near to, so as synonymous for, as another way to express what you just said. I mean, that I don't deny that there are facts in the sense that the newspapers are full of facts. In that sense, I would say what you actually mean, or you could express this in another way by saying that newspapers are full of true statements, or statements or things that you say. So something that is part of language that is accepted as true by a certain amount of people that have certain authority, for instance. So, in other words, the expression fact in ordinary language has many senses. What I deny is that there is one sense, a very technical sense, that is used by a philosopher. And in the first part of the book, this technical sense is called compositional fact. And this is a very specific kind of entity, a very specific kind of complex entity that philosopher assumes in some cases to be, say, what the world is made of. And in this sense, we are talking of an entity which is complex, that is formally structured. Meaning is whatever fact you take, this is structured always in the same way, okay? No matter its subject matter, so to speak. There's always the same kind of structure facts have. And they have a very special kind of articulation, one can say, a very specific kind of a combination, a way in which they are structured. In technical terms, this is called a non-mereological kind of glue or combination or constitution, we can say sometimes. Mm-hmm. That means that these very specific kind of complexes have also a technical kind of articulation. And that's a technical difference indeed. And then I say that this kind of technical artifact, this kind of very specific notion that is accepted by certain philosophers, I say that these things we should not accept in the catalog of the world.
Okay. Let's start with that particular conception of facts. I mean, you give, okay, so in the first part, you know, like chapters 2 and 3, you present this, what you call the compositional fact. And a paradigm example of that is David Armstrong and his truthmaker argument, right? His idea that there are facts, there are that these, as you put it, they are entities kind of, or states of affairs, maybe glued together with this non-meriological glue, and that we need these things to be the truth makers of our true statements. That you know, so just taking, I mean, you can speak more generally or specify Armstrong's view in particular. But why, you know, what's the motivation for positing, you know, this particular kind of non-meriologically glued together entity, i.e. compositional fact, and, you know, and what's your basic argument for why the arguments for it just don't hold up?
So, Armstrong the general context for accepting that makes it sensible to accept facts as truth makers, and that's the role they play in this framework, is truth. So it's a particular theory of truth that Armstrong accepts. That's a specific variant, a specific version of the so-called correspondence theory of truth, where you have statements in language that have a certain content, and they can be true or false. When they are truths, let's say, take a true statement. There's one example I have in the book. I like hedgehogs very much. So an example I have in the book is a hedgehog that's called Hargo, by the way. So Hargo is lying on Argo's lap. Or we can say Hargo is lying on Bargo's lap, so where we distinguish the two people, so the hedgehog and the person. So suppose you have this statement, and Armstrong would say, so to be true, this statement, well, what does it mean, in fact? What makes it true? In what way is its truth of this, the root of this statement, grounded in the world? So there must be something, in fact. So there is a relationship between this statement and the world. That's a very basic assumption, any correspondence theory of truth. In his case, we assume that there is, first of all, the sentence has to do somehow with objects such as this hedgehog, Hargo, with a relation, say, of lying on, and with another object, Bargo. And these three things exist, and these display a role in the truth of the statement, Argos is lying on Bargo's lap. But that's not enough, says Armstrong. So you need something else in the world for that sentence, in fact, that statement to be true. What's that? Well, it's a particular arrangement or composition, a combination of these three things together, which is itself a fourth thing. And that's very unintuitive to anybody in the street that has not studied much of philosophy, you would say. The reason is that is in the nature of what you take the relation lying on to be. If, like Armstrong, you take the relation of lying on to be non-specific to particular things it attaches to, so non-specific to the relata that it relates, then you could have, in a world, a hedgehog, Hargo, the very same hedgehog, Hargo, the very same place, Bargo's lap, and a relation of lying on. But that relation, technically speaking, we say, may be instantiated in something else. There could be a cup or your computer now. You're interviewing me. There is a computer lying on your desk, probably, or a cup lying on your desk. That's a line. But it's another line. It's somewhere else. There could be these three things, but not connected. And a world in which they are connected contains so a fourth object, their being together. And that's itself, this being together of these three entities, it's a state of affairs, says Armstrong. I call it fact in the book to make it easy. But so Armstrong calls it a state of affairs, but in fact, it's a fact how I define it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you need that. You need this fourth object mm-hmm. to be the truth maker. So meaning the object in virtue of which the statement Hargo's lying on Bargo's lap is true.
Mm-hmm. And you argue that we don't need to posit these four things, right?
Yes, that's exactly what I argue. I argue that we don't need to posit these four things once that you give up one of the premises of the argument, meaning the nature of the relation involved. So the need in this framework, the need of truth makers in the sense I sketched, is such that given the fact that you accept relations that are non-specific to the relator in question, mm-hmm. you need to have something that accounts for the being specific, so for this relation to be, in fact, related or being actually connecting these, they are the two things it relates.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that is there is no need once that you give up one premise, meaning the nature that has to do with the nature of the relation.
So, sorry, you're saying that there are no, to use Armstrong's own vocabulary of universals, that there are no sort of general, there are no relations, there are only just individual, you know, very individual relations. There's no sort of common relations. There's, in other words, everything is, you know, just like Argel is a name, then is on top of is also a kind of weird name in a way.
Yes. So, indeed, while Armstrong is accepting universals, so relations and universals, I don't, or at least I argue in the book, that it's much better. It has fewer costs and higher benefits and more benefits not to do that, not to accept universals. But there is a complication here.
Mm-hmm.
How I explain in chapter 3, it's not so much the universals versus non-universal relations, or in other words, following philosophers, the universals versus tropes. So the technical term that is used here is that if you only have, say, individual accidents or individual instantiations of relations, it are called relational tropes.
Right.
So, but it's not so much this opposition that is key in the premise that I think is in question here, mm-hmm. but this specific quality or specific characteristic of relations that is its specificity. So it's being specific to a particular relata or not. And that's in itself a conceptual difference. So conceptually, it's not the same thing as being a universal or not. You could have universals that are relata specific. This is a very complicated situation. If you accept both universals and you accept that those universals are in fact specific to the relata in question, it's a bit of a complicated case, but I cannot exclude it on the basis of the analysis I give in the book. So you could have, in fact, universal relations and those relations being specific to the very relata that they relate. In this case, you have no unity problem.
Okay. But is it that they're not sort of not actually multiply instantiated, or that they, you know, what makes it the case that a universal would only be specific to some particular case?
Well, probably, but this is the kind of let's say this is the option I do not really develop in the book. Okay. What I say is that this is conceptually possible. I'm not saying that it's we exclude that there is any possible theory based on this assumption that there are universal relations and they are relata specific. It's complicated because you would need to assume it would be quite costly, I think. But in itself, assuming that would solve the unity problem. So it would be such that the problem I call, in the tradition, is called the unity problem that I discuss in chapter 2. This won't arise. So I wanted to show up, to show exactly what is exactly the responsible assumption, and what is the thing that you assume in the world that makes it such that you have a unity problem. And that's the specificity of the relation, not necessarily universal or non-universal. So to conclude, it's very complicated because you would need to assume a universal that has, say, a specific time-bound slot. So you would need to explain how then are you then in a totally determined world? The moment that universal that is specific exists, it would determine all the future relation, actual instantiation of that relation once it exists for a time one. It would come up with lots of time slots. In fact, you would need to assume something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in effect, it's sort of like, well, do we have the argument for these truth makers, states of affairs with their non-meriological glue, in effect depends on a prior or concurrent commitment to universals. And you're sort of saying, well, we don't really need the universals, so we don't need the glued states of affairs either.
Yeah, so if you insist that you have universals and they are non-specific to the relator that you need to glue, say, mm-hmm. then you get the unity problem. If you just do away with universals and then you accept tropes, mm-hmm. Under certain say further assumptions, meaning that these tropes are also specific to the relator, because that's the complication. There are theories in which tropes are such that they could, in fact, pertain to different relata than they do. So you have to assume a specifically strong conception of tropes, where the tropes really cannot possibly attach to another relata. And that's a strong assumption. And I do say that you have that assumption, in fact. And that still assuming that and going that way is the solution to be preferred, if at all you accept at all relations in the world.
Okay. You also mentioned the correspondence theory of truth, which, obviously Armstrong is a proponent of, and he's defending that. One of the things I was thinking was, you don't consider, at least as far as I recall at length, a deflationary theory of truth, where you kind of like eliminate the need to posit, these things as truth makers, because there's no need to even have a truth maker role to begin with.
Exactly.
Because you don't even need a correspondence theory of truth. And I was wondering, did you, consider that option, or just sort of say, well, facts are playing this role of truth makers for correspondence theorists, and therefore, I'm just going to kind of play their game.
Yeah, so that's exactly that's a good question. That's exactly what I did. I mean, you could, of course, just say, look, if there is no role to be played, so the no truth making role, and we don't need any truth makers, and in particular not in the version that Armstrong is assuming, then, there is no fact of the matter in the sense that there is no need for anything to be playing that role. You could, but that's, of course, a bit further away from this framework. So in philosophy, you need to be sort of careful or problematize a certain framework, but not by, taking a completely different way of doing things, because then the dialogue is a bit between two different worlds, so to speak.
Right.
I personally think I have some sympathies. If I have some sympathies for a correspondentist theory, that would be a very weak kind of correspondentist theory without truth makers, so to speak. That's a quite conservative in that sense. I'm not even sure that I want to defend a correspondentist theory, but I know that I don't want to defend, in fact, a correspondence theory that has truth makers.
Okay. Although you do, I think you do say later that we, you know, either we do need something to play the role, or at least we need some sort of, well, was maybe we should get to that later on, you know, how exactly we account for, you know, the use of the truth predicate and so forth. So let me just let's talk about the second type of fact, which is the what you call the propositional fact. And this one is, I guess, more closely associated with Frege, right? These sort of, you know, mind and language independent, you know, abstract entities that, you know, have their meanings essentially and so forth. So what's, this is a somewhat more complicated argument, which involves a lot more linguistics because, you know, here the idea, the starting idea is, well, we have these sentences, that have that clauses in them, you know, so I, you know, believe that my computer is on the desk, or to use two of the examples sort of that you, variations that you use, you know, I notice that the computer's on the desk versus I believe that, say, the computer's on the desk. And so this, in both cases, you have noticed that and then believe that, and they seem to refer to, there seems to be some thing, you know, that clause refers to because of various ways that you can talk about that. So that's a very familiar picture of, you know, of propositions and why one needs to posit propositions, you know, as the reference of that clauses. So can you say a bit about, you know, sort of more specifically maybe about the propositional fact? And then the first stage of your argument involves, claiming that we don't need them because that clauses don't refer. They're not referring terms. And then you go on from there. But let's just start with that part.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so this, as you said, these facts are a bit more obscure, I would say. And the argument I use to dismiss them is very long. It's really, really complicated. It takes about 100 pages. The general idea is this. I must say that I had some difficulties in the beginning when I was, so my attention was attracted to the fact that, you know, there were not just only compositional facts. So these are the ones that I was very familiar with when I was writing my dissertation. I was trying to know more about them. But then it was soon clear that, philosophers also, when they talk about facts, they might talk about a different type of facts, and those are typically objects or entities that are linked to a certain use of language. So in this case, facts have been assumed, and that's something that happened in a tradition that is, say, more a philosophy of language oriented and nearer to certain studies in linguistics in the 60s and the 70s. So the notion of fact was used in combination, or say in relation with the working of, as you mentioned, that clauses. So uses of that clauses in language. And the idea was, and is still very popular among philosophers, that there are at least certain uses of that clauses. In particular, some people have defended the idea that what you call, indeed, well, you gave an example of a factive that clause. So I noticed that there is a book on this table, that the working of such a sentence, if true at least, would be such that these particular sentence would be constructed in such a way that there will be a subject, so an I, and then a verb, an action, a notice, or an event, and then something else, which is, say, the object of these noticing, which is that a book is on the table. And given the superficial appearance and use of this, the way in which this sentence is constructed, if true, it would seem very intuitive, very plain thing to do, to take this, what is named by that this book is on the table, this construction, to be an object. Maybe a special object, but an object nonetheless. So a literature originated in which the working of that clause is taken very seriously and paired off with, indeed, objects, entities in a philosopher's say, toolbox. But what I discovered pretty soon was that these kind of facts, those that are supposedly referred to by at least some of that clauses, are not the same as the compositional facts in Armstrong's style, but are different kinds of facts. And they are much, they have different characteristics. And it was quite difficult to understand exactly what characteristics they might have, or at least what philosophers thought of other philosophers in the literature thought of how they thought of, in fact, these facts. They have some characteristics that are similar to propositions, those of propositions, considered to be, so propositions in this case are the ideal, they are ideal entities, so outside time and space, those ideal entities that work as the meanings of statements or the meanings of sentences. But even if you assume these objects or propositions as the meanings of statements and so on, you still would distinguish, at least these philosophers did, distinguish between propositions and a different entity, which can be aptly called a proposition of fact. And these entities are different from compositional facts in the sense that, first of all, they are not considered to be in the world. More is maybe the figure that is more strictly associated with propositional facts. And a linguist in the 60s, so Zeno Wendler, that is still referred to by some philosophers today, they characterize this fact as being unstructured. So that's different from the kind of facts we discussed in the beginning. So they are unstructured. They are not in any sense composed of objects, and still they are about objects. This is similar to a proposition. So they have some quasi-semantics or characteristics, meaning that these are entities that are somehow related in a very unspecific way to objects in the world. They themselves, these propositional facts, are not part of the furniture of the world. They are not in the world. They do not have any causal powers. They are essentially ideal entities. But it is said they are not statements. They are not language entities, but also not propositions as the meanings of those sentences or the content of those sentences. They are something else. And it's this last part, that they are something else, that I take issue with. So I say, look, if you assume, it's fine if you really want to assume propositions, although I deny that this is a sensible thing to do, but even though you insist that there are propositions, then there is no way that you can show that there are also propositional facts. This is really implausible. So this is one of the things I say. Another thing I say is, so the first part, the point about propositions, I do not defend propositions, in fact. What I say is that, the book is not called Against Propositions, that's all.
Right.
But the first part of the argument, the one that you mentioned so rightly, it's about showing that clauses do not refer. That one is, this is chapter 4, that's the beginning of the second part. This is really an argument that can be used against propositions as well. So it doesn't matter. It's really against any kind of entity that you take to be the referent of a that clause. And this is because it's really just about the fact that clauses really are not the same kind of entity as, or say, a part of speech like a name or anything like that. Really, they are not what philosophers call singular term. And singular terms are parts of speech. a typical example, which is a proper name, such as Carrie, Ariana, or Bargo. Those names are such parts of speech that refer to objects out there. These are the typical sort of middle-sized goods, three-dimensional objects that we have experience of around us in the world. And so that names, you know, are used to refer to those objects is pretty, I'll say, I would not say entirely uncontroversial, because in philosophy, of course, is basically nothing that is uncontroversial, but let's say it's fairly uncontroversial. Mm-hmm. Now, what is much more controversial, what I say it is, in fact, controversial, and it's very implausible, and I show to be false, in fact, is that that clauses work like proper names. So they, in fact, do not refer to anything. They do not pick up an object in the world, no matter how special this object is. And that's so this argument really it's rather articulated in four different say steps, and this shows that neither propositions nor facts should be assumed. Then I have a fallback position, and that's a position in which I say, look, even though you prove me wrong, or you know, you can show that after all that clauses do refer, then that clauses would not in any case refer to facts, considering taking facts to be these very special propositional facts as different from true propositions.
Let me just, before you move on to the fallback positions. Are you, I don't know if you're using the term refer, you know, technically such that, you know, only names refer and, yep, you know, predicates denote or something like that.
Yes, I do. Yeah,
you are. Okay. So let me just, so even if that clauses aren't singular terms or don't act as singular terms and therefore they don't refer, they could still correspond or denote the way, you know, a common term, you know, as opposed to a name, might refer, like, you know, cup, you know, cup refers to, and then you can give some theory of, you know, the set of cups or the class of cups or something along those lines. Right.
Yeah.
So, is part of your argument here, and maybe it's just implicit that, you've already kind of taken away the idea that even if they're not singular terms, right, they're also not general terms either.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. You're right. This is an excellent question. So I do not really explicitly take issue with this, because indeed, as you are suggesting now, it would follow pretty straightforwardly that the option of taking them to be general terms is not really viable. I do something similar in the following step, when I say that the predicate is a fact, is not a real predicate. To be able to do what you suggest, so that you would take them to be common names, so predicates, or you know, use it to be as a common noun, such as cop, so is a cop, for instance. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, there is no linguistic analogy between that clauses and a word like cop, or at least you know, you would have something like is a cop, or you would have something like is at that blah blah blah, which is ungrammatical. So there are several aspects of the analogy. So you would first need to show that there is a linguistic analogy between the two kinds of expressions, which I think is really pretty difficult to show. I would say that it's a bit of a hopeless case. And if it's there is no analogy, which is one of the other, actually one of the two criteria. So I mentioned one one criteria for deciding about existence in the beginning of this conversation. And what pops up now is another criteria, in fact, that I'm using throughout the book as a meta-philosophical, say, and meta-metaphysical criterion, which is kind of a way to decide whenever a certain object falls under a certain description, or say whenever a certain object falls under a certain characterization, such as, and then you would, for that, you would need a definition, or at least a kind of very plausible analogy. So to show what you, so your idea here was, how about, say, arguing that clauses, if they are not singular terms, how about they might be, you know, similar to a predicate or a common noun. Mm-hmm. In this case, you would need to have a very plausible analogy between the working of the common nouns and the working of that clauses. And I think it's pretty dim perspective, I would say.
Okay. So back to the fallback position. I mean, mm-hmm. so in the final two prongs of this particular argument against propositional facts, so you sort of give a reductio where, you know, even if you accept that they are singular, you know, that clauses are singular terms, and they do refer, there's still no reason for us to posit facts, or as you put it more specifically, there's no reason to posit factive propositions as opposed to just any other sort of, or any proposition in general. In other words, there's no reason to think that there's this other special class. There's just, yeah. If you accept proposition, that's enough. You don't need facts.
Yes, indeed. That is exactly what the fallback position says. And so the way in which this fallback argument works is a bit different from the way in which the argument against the referring power or capacity of that clauses work. And here I use a couple of argumentative turns or moves from metaphysics, where the first, say, the first argument about that clauses is really almost, you don't need much metaphysics to have this go through. It's in fact linguistics and philosophy of language. And the second part, I mean, the fallback position really does require certain metaphysical considerations. For instance, one of which is to show that first of all, if you take that process very seriously, as a referring entities, the only kind of objects or entities that you can pair off with them as being a referent, if you insist that some of them at least are facts, are a very specific kind of fact, meaning the propositional facts, those that I characterize like that. Sorry. And that's because of a certain restrictions that you need to put, or say certain requirements that you must have to have, say, a viable kind of entity that will be referred to every that clause that you want to be referring, meaning, for instance, disjunctive that clauses. So given the way these facts are introduced, they need to be also referent of any true proposition. And you can have, of course, true propositions that are disjunctive. And then you will need to have that true proposition to be paired off in a very, very strong correspondentist theory of truth with a propositional fact, which is disjunctive. And those kind of facts cannot possibly be compositional ones. So that's one argument to show that that shows that if you really take that clauses very seriously, to take these facts to be whatever is referred to by that clauses, those need to be special kinds of facts, or the propositional ones. And now the problem starts, because what I then argue is to show, look, there is no plausible way to show that these so-called propositional facts are different from propositions, purely Frege style, as the third world kind of entities that work as the meanings of statements. Yeah, that's it. And the complication here is that it's a kind of reduction, so to speak. So what I do is to show, look, I say that there is no way to distinguish the two, so to accept facts alongside true propositions. And then I show that six attempts to block this move of mine fail. So basically, there is no way to avoid this. That's how I argue.
Okay. So one of the things that you conclude is you say that you do accept. I mean, there's a number of roles, right? That, you know, in the philosophical chapter in the beginning about, you know, what the various roles are. We've mentioned, you know, specifically, you know, the role of playing the truth maker, or the role of playing the referent of that clause, and there were some others as well.
Yep.
So, you know, if you don't have, you know, these non-meriological states of affairs, and you don't have propositions, or at least factive propositions, what are the roles that you think, you know, that you think we still need to have filled, and how do you fill them if you don't have facts to fill them?
Yeah, so I think so. There are two roles that say what I call, these are semantical roles. That means that these are roles that entities can play in their, say, interplay, or in the crossroads or intersection, say, between language, mind, and world. So if you see this as a map, then you can play certain roles that, given the relation that entities have in this space, in this conceptual space, can play. For instance, I identify five of them. There may be more, but what is really relevant, for what's relevant here, there are like five. So truth maker is one of them. As we talked about truth makers, there are other roles. One is a truth bearer. So what object plays the role of the thing which is truth, or the thing that can be called truth essentially or primarily? And there are several candidates, say, to play this role, several actors to play this role. And these are all entities such as statements or judgments or claims or propositions and so on. I think the role of truth bearer, so of the thing or the entity that we call or that is true primarily or in first instance, that needs to be played by an entity. The meaning of a truth bearer, I don't think there are really good reasons to think that has to be played by the entity. And the same for truth making. So I would say truth bearer, yes, we need to have it played by an entity. Mm-hmm. And the other object that other entity or role, say, that needs to be fulfilled, I will say, is the subject of sentence subject, in the sense of whatever is referred to by the subject of a sentence. So if you say, for instance, Carrie is interviewing Arianna, well, then Carrie is such that's a part of speech in that sentence. And somehow in the world, it has to be an object that is picked out by that sentence. By the subject of the sentence, Carrie. Mm-hmm. Still, I would say this too needs to be played. Although the first time I would say, yes, we need an object to play it. The second one, I'm still researching that, say. But given a very minimalistic take on this, say, based on consensus of the most general theory and most general position we can have, I would say truth bearer needs to be played by an entity.
Okay. So let me just ask about your nominalism. So, you know, you've mentioned, I mean, obviously this is not a book against propositions. It's just against facts, you know, but there's a very strong current of nominalism here, where, you mm-hmm. know, we don't need universals, and we probably don't need propositions, mm. and
yes.
you know, a lot of these, you know, strange creatures in the philosopher's cave. And so I was just wondering, you know, sort of, it's a two-pronged sort of question. You know, when you say there are no facts, are you sort of being an eliminativist about the, or just a sort of a reductionist that whatever, you know, we don't. So as you put it before, when we were discussing Armstrong, you know, it's like there was Argyle, there was being on top of, and then there was the other person or hedgehog, whatever.
Yeah.
And then there was no need to posit a fourth thing. And that kind of sounds like, you know, that seems like we don't need anything over and above. We can, if you want to talk about the facts, you know, they can just be, you know, metaphysically reduced to these other things. There's no need to posit something else.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, so one aspect of the nominalism question is, you know, are you eliminativist or reductivist about facts? And then just more generally, are you, you know, how deep or wide does your nominalism go?
Well, that's, I would say, pretty deep. One thing is that, so I have sympathies for a position that is really pretty radical about sort of nominalism and in general not there being any non-mereological composition in the world. I do not defend a very radical position in the book because I don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
So if the book was about, oh yeah, what I think about this or that and anything and philosophical theories, that would have to include a more radical position. But for facts here, I really didn't need to go that far. So there are my sympathies and there are also things that you can responsibly say. And I try in the book to say things that I think I can responsibly say, which are two different things. Your question about the reductionism or the eliminativism, I would say that, again, my sympathies are for the elimination, so the eliminativism position, but I think you can also go for, given certain assumptions and given certain premises or certain frameworks, you can very well go for a reductionist position on facts with the proviso that you accept that there is no one-on-one correspondence, that whatever you can call a fact would be reduced to the very same object all the time for every single mention you make of a fact. If you go for reductionism, what you can do is, okay, look, when we talk about facts, you can take it even very seriously with the proviso that sometimes you accept that this entity, the entity that would correspond to this talk, would be an event. Or in another case, the entity we are talking about might very well be, given a certain framework, a meteorological complex. And in even another case, you would have a complete elimination or complete, say, take on the use of the word fact as to simply being a linguistic alternative to, you know, saying something else, meaning, you know, the discovery, whatever, what we can say. Oh, yeah, you had an example at the beginning when you said, look, when you the newspapers are full of facts, right? And they say the Earth revolves around the sun. You could say the Earth revolves around the sun is a fact if you really want to emphasize that this is a particular kind of statement. But you could very well simply say the Earth revolves around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, is a fact would be used for emphasis. So in some cases, you would not need the word. In some cases, you would, but then there would be no one-one correspondence between the word fact and whatever I think that should be paired off in the world with it.
Okay. So, it kind of sounds like a deflationary theory of facts, you know?
Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
Although our use of is a fact is not nearly as systematic as our use of the truth predicate. So that might be a difficulty.
Yes. Yeah, it might very well be. And I don't think there is indeed pairing off or correspondence between, whenever you say is a fact, what you mean, or you could substitute for every occurrence of this word something else. Mm-hmm. I think here really a pluralist account of what could be paired off if you really, really want to take language that seriously, then you would need certainly a kind of much more pluralistic attitude to it.
Okay, so I think we have time for one sort of final substantive question. What do you see as the main implications of your view of facts for related, you know, issues in philosophy of mind and philosophy of language?
So this is a wonderful question. I would say that also a very difficult one because, so philosophy of mind, of course, is one thing, and I tend to see it as really quite, it should be far more removed from philosophy of language as it is normally treated, in fact. It's difficult to say. I would certainly say that the implication, the more obvious and direct implication is that, you know, not to take seriously any talk of propositional attitudes, not in the way in which propositional attitudes are normally construed. Mm-hmm. Meaning, as I mentioned, you know, that whenever we have a construction such as "I believe that this book is on the table," I would say, no, you cannot take it seriously as being, you know, an assertion in which you have a subject, an action or an event and an object. Mm-hmm. That for sure. There are also finer things that I'm not really sure about. And so does that mean that any kind of mental content would be eschewed, that you know, you cannot accept that's not true? I mean, that doesn't follow, not necessarily. I would need, you know, another book to show that or not. And the philosophy of language, of course, so propositions are, that's the connection you might want to have. So in this case, if you also in philosophy of language, you want to rely on propositional attitudes in the sense that to take also those constructions seriously, also in philosophy of language, then yes, the direct consequence would be that you can't really that lightly accept them. You will need to go for an alternative reading of such constructions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think we're out of time, so I'd like to end with a question about where you go from here. I mean, are you pursuing some of the, you know, other issues raised by this book, or are you turning to something else entirely?
No, so yeah. One thing is that, as I said, I started with the in fact the history of the notion of fact, and so I have I plan at a certain point to publish a book or booklet on it to show when facts really emerged in this sense of compositional ones in history. That's somewhat related. At least I will use my sort of definition of fact, which I put forward in this book, a compositional fact in that other book. The other thing I want to go on with is the philosophy of linguistics. Mm-hmm. So more methodological questions related to what can linguistics say, or can what we as philosophers of language can say about linguistics, or that route. And the third thing is much more general approach to tracing concepts through time. So what I'm doing now, I have just gotten a project that would do that for the next 5 years, is tracing concepts through time by using computational tools.
Well, very interesting. I look forward to hearing about that project. So, or all of them, actually, but that one in particular seems very, very interesting.
Thank you.
So, well, we are out of time. So I do want to thank you again for being so open about your book and talking with us about it. And I wish you luck with your future projects.
Thank you very much, and thanks for interviewing me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Arianna Betty, professor of philosophy at the University of Amsterdam. We've been talking about her new book, Against Facts, which is just out from the MIT Press. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.